This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Having a hard time keeping up with the latest in Washington, from tax plans to health care, lawmakers on Capitol Hill have a lot to accomplish before the end of the year. Today, Connecticut 2nd District Congressman Joe Courtney joins us in studio to answer your questions. Courtney, a Democrat, was first elected to the U.S. House in 2006. He's a member of several committees, including Armed Services, ranking member of the Sea Power and Projection Forces Subcommittee, where he advocates for federal contracts that benefit submarine builder Electric Boat in Groton. He's also helped secure investment dollars for sub-base New London. Congressman Courtney, welcome back to the show.
Good to be here, Lucy.
Now, our conversation is also being broadcast on Facebook Live. Just search Where We Live. If you have a comment for Congressman Courtney, you can type it in the comment field below the live video stream, or you can talk to us the old-fashioned way by phone. Our studio number is 860-275-7266. Find us on Twitter at Where We Live. So let's just jump right in. We've got the big GOP tax plan.
Right.
And last Thursday, we know the U.S. House passed this bill. You voted against it. Before we find out why, I wanted to play a clip from President Trump describing the GOP tax proposal.
And that's why we're working to give the American people a giant tax cut for Christmas. We are giving them a big, beautiful Christmas present in the form of a tremendous tax cut.
So President Trump wants to see this bill on his desk by Christmas. You've got some major reservations. Tell us why.
Yeah, unfortunately, for a lot of people, it'll be coal in their stocking when this bill, if it ever passes. As we know, there's about a half dozen senators that are very shaky right now in terms of what came out of the Senate Finance Committee early Thursday morning last week. There's a number of sort of issues here, as we learned again overnight. You know, a third outside group calculated the long-term impact in terms of the deficit for our country and, again, confirmed that it's going to be well over $1 trillion over the next 10 years. Again, there's been the Tax Policy Center was last night. There's a number of other really respected neutral groups. The Tax Foundation, which is a conservative analyst, also found the same thing. You know, again, there are times when, you know, the economy is in a recession or struggling where, you know, some deficit spending over a short period of time can be justified. Keynesian economics, which I think, you know, some upset some of your listeners. But again, I actually, you know, think that that is a valid approach. But in this case, what we're talking about is a structural deficit to help pay for tax cuts that really, I don't think, do much in terms of stimulating growth. Again, eliminating the estate tax for 2.2% of the American population, I just think that is just defies any analysis that that's going to really benefit in terms of job growth or investment in the U.S. economy, for example. So there's that sort of overarching issue in terms of, you know, what is the payback for something that is that damaging in terms of our overall fiscal health. Secondly, in terms of tax incidence, in other words, where do the tax falls? Mm-hmm. Again, too many middle class families are going to take it in the back of the neck. And, you know, in Connecticut, where we are a state where a large number of middle class families itemize on their deductions. They don't do it because they enjoy, you know, the complexity of it. But there is clearly targeted benefits with some of these itemized deductions, whether it's state and local taxes, medical expenses, student loans, interest payments that are all being swept away in this measure. And what you get back for it is an increase of a standard deduction, which, again, there are some folks out there that, you know, the math may work for them, but really on a pretty sort of marginal basis in terms of what kind of savings they would get. And for a lot of people, like a woman I spoke to in Old Saybrook a couple nights ago, whose husband has Alzheimer's and is in a facility that they're dishing out between $150,000 and $200,000 this year, losing that medical expense deduction is just an enormous hit on somebody who's doing the right thing. I mean, they're paying their bills and they're taking care of someone with a very serious chronic illness, which is why that deduction was created to begin with. The state and local tax, there's been a lot in the press, and Connecticut is clearly a state that would really take a big hit as a result of that. We're a donor state already. $8 billion goes to Washington every year, that more than we get back, despite, you know, some of the good news down at the shipyard. And this will aggravate that because it's just going to raise people's tax bill because of losing that deduction. And again, the last thing I would just say really quick, this economy right now, where we are sort of hovering near full employment by many measurements. We need to be focusing on giving people skills to take advantage of a lot of job openings that are out there in the economy. And this not only doesn't do anything for that, it actually goes backwards in terms of eliminating some of the tax incentives for employers, workers, students to get skilled up to take advantage of job openings. And to me, that should be our number one focus right now as a Congress and as a country. And that's not happening in this tax bill.
You mentioned the Tax Policy Center. This is a nonpartisan tax analysis group. Its report on the GOP tax plan says that all income groups would see tax reductions on average under the Senate bill in 2019. Then 9% of taxpayers would pay higher taxes that year than under current law. By 2027, the proportion would grow to 50%. So largely because the personal tax cuts expire in 2026. That's what Republicans did to curb budget deficits the bill would create. So while it sounds good in the beginning, it's the benefits to the middle class, as you say, would be very limited years out.
And it undercuts the argument this is about simplifying the tax code, because, you know, it to have this sort of chutes and ladders tax rate built into it obviously is, you know, makes your head spin in terms of just trying to evaluate and plan as a family or as an individual, you know, about life decisions.
Now, you mentioned how this bill, this GOP tax plan, is going to impact college students, looking at also how it would harm apprenticeship programs. Let's get more detailed on that. Let's first talk about repealing student loan interest deductions, also how this could hit graduate students. Can you walk us through some of the basics?
So, yeah, last Wednesday night when I had 2 minutes to speak on the floor, that was my focus. Because, again, I really think this gets to the, you know, real guts of Connecticut, which is that we succeed based on what's between our ears. And to the extent that we're creating barriers for people to take advantage of college or graduate school or apprenticeship programs, you know, we're really shooting ourselves in the foot here. The bill eliminates the interest payment deduction for college students, which, according to the, you know, all the analysis, is about an additional $71 billion burden to people who are borrowing to pay for college, which is a lot of people. I mean, there's about 15 million students across the country that use the Stafford Student Loan Program. And that interest rate deduction is one of the few ways that you can manage your debt in terms of trying to take some of the brunt of that when after you graduate. Again, that was eliminated in this bill. Secondly, tuition waivers, which for a graduate student up at UConn who's a researcher or a teaching assistant, again, one of the ways that they can sort of deal with the fact that their income level is not, you know, out in the workplace, out in the economy, that they are not charged interest. They're not charged tuition while they're there. So, and that is waived as taxable income. This actually will basically treat that tuition benefit as a tax, as a taxable income. So, if you're, you know, a graduate student, that's about $25,000-$30,000 that's being added to your taxable income. You're not getting any cash. Or you know, a salary for that. So that is a total pure hit in terms of extra tax that you have to pay. We have gotten hundreds of emails from stores into my office from, you know, people who are by and large doing the stuff that we want in our economy. 60% of the tuition waivers are in STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math. I mean, really, that is a universal consensus policy for educators and employers out there that, you know, those are the skills that we need to be promoting. That's where the highest income jobs are out there in the economy. And this just, again, obliterates what is one of the effective ways that institutions like UConn, Yale, again, across the board, help sort of get people into graduate programs and take their skills to a higher level. Lastly, employer-assisted tuition, which again, from, you know, healthcare to manufacturing to finance, again, if you've got a young employee with a real spark and that, you know, can really benefit from going to school, again, that's a benefit that they can offer, and it's not taxable. And that's being, again, that tax exemption is being eliminated. It was amazing to watch this coalition just come up out of nowhere. It's like a pop-up, you know, group. And the breadth of employers and educational institutions that united around this was just incredible. And, you know, that this really smart policy to really, again, hone and improve employee skills is being eliminated. And again, apprenticeships are one of those apprenticeship programs and mentor, you know, that are built around trades is, again, one of the examples of where employers have used that to really strengthen their workforce.
Second District Congressman Joe Courtney is in studio with us on Where We Live. You can join the conversation, 860-275-7266. Also find us on Facebook Live. Just search Where We Live, and you can put your question or comment in the comments field. Cody is calling from Portland. Cody, you're on the show.
Hi, I think you actually just answered my question. Thank you for having me on the show. But I was wondering what would happen under the GOP tax bill with what would happen with regards to employee compensation for graduate programs and things like that.
Well, yeah, we just ran through the list there, and as I said, we got about 1,800 emails and calls, and the window that this bill was considered was about 13 days, and about nine of those were business days, and to get that kind of volume. And again, these were not sort of, you know, click a petition kind of emails. I mean, these were people who were sitting down and really, you know, thinking and writing their own personal story. And that tuition waiver and the employee educational assistance was, you know, very much high on the depth chart in terms of the volume that we got.
So there's the House bill that passed, and now it's going to be before the Senate after the Thanksgiving recess. I mean, how are these bills different, and how can lawmakers, I mean, they have people who benefit from the programs we were just talking about in
right.
their districts, whether they're Republican or Democrat, how can they reconcile that with this proposal?
So, again, it's moving at Mach speed, which, again, by itself is really the warning flag should be up, because the law of unintended consequences happens when you rush things. And we're talking about the biggest rewrite of the tax code since 1986. Again, the Senate Finance Committee party line vote reported out around midnight or early morning hours last Thursday. Their version, there are just differences. Again, the House bill capped the, you know, the local tax deductibility so that, again, folks who pay property taxes up to $10,000 can still deduct in the House bill. In the Senate bill, they eliminate even that measure of protection, so that for, again, a state like Connecticut, that's like going in the wrong direction. So in terms of now you get no deductibility for state and local. On the other hand, they restored the medical expense deduction, and it's not clear, frankly, on the education side. I mean, this thing is moving so fast, trying to sort of keep up with what the latest changes are. But those are actually just those two, for example. It's a pretty big, you know, sort of delta between the two sides. And it shows how, you know, if you try and protect, you know, one group in terms of the medical expense, you're going to, you know, hurt the groups that have high property taxes. And they also somewhat phase in the estate tax elimination on the Senate side. And the same thing with corporate tax cut. They delay it a year. And as you point out, they've got the, you know, the chutes and ladders on the personal rates here. So these bills are actually very they've got a lot of, you know, gaps between the two sides. And, you know, the president said he wants to do it by Christmas. I mean, maybe they can. I there's a lot of political impetus that's driving this, as we all know. They feel the need to deliver you know, something that was sort of on the campaign trail last November. But again, if you go back to 1986 when Ronald Reagan was president and Tip O'Neill and Dan, you know, it was a well over a year process, very open and transparent, normal order. And frankly, that's been totally brushed aside. And that's when you're going to have problems.
Let's talk about health care. We know that there have been Republican proposals to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act. There was a provision in the Senate bill to repeal the individual mandate or requirement for people to have health insurance. Now we're hearing from the Washington Post that President Trump's budget director said that the White House is willing to remove this contentious provision, taking aim at the ACA, if they can get that tax bill signed by Christmas. What are your concerns?
Well, again, this is a perfect example of where, you know, they're looking for that 50th vote. Mm-hmm. And that's driving decisions that really have a profound impact on, you know, Americans all across the country. And that's not the way to do it. I mean, to be just blunt about it, the Congressional Budget Office calculated that that provision that you just cited would result in 13 million people losing their insurance. It would destabilize insurance markets even more. Again, talking about the pop-up coalitions that this bill is driving, that happened within really half a day of that provision being announced, which, again, all the healthcare stakeholders that united in opposition to repeal are now sort of back in the game again. They, you know, at some point, I guess, were taking assurances that they were going to leave that alone, you know, which the leadership in the House and Senate was telling people just, you know, a matter of weeks ago. The scoring of that provision generates some savings, and I think that is partly what's going on there in the Senate, is that they're you know, going to try and plug that in as a pay for to eliminate some of the more difficult provisions that were in the House bill. But that, again, that's just, you know, we're playing squeeze a balloon. We're not playing, you know, real sort of measured tax policy.
So the idea by repealing the individual mandate, less people are insured, and then the government doesn't have to pay the subsidies for this care.
Right.
You had mentioned also, I think, Medicare proposal to
right.
expand. We've heard Senator Bernie Sanders mention Medicare for all or single payer. But how is your the proposal that you're backing different, and how would that help?
So, again, I think the message that I think came through loud and clear from the American public during the whole 9 or 10 month ordeal on repeal and replace was that what they wanted, what I think most people want, is fixes and ways to address, you know, really some of the problems in the Affordable Care Act, which I think, again, any rational person understands that there are. I mean, there isn't any law. And one of the biggest problems is that if you look at the rates that just came out this year on the exchange in Connecticut, because we still have 3-to-1 age rating under the Affordable Care Act, again, that they compacted the age rating, which used to be 5-to-1, 6-to-1, down to 3-to-1. But that's still a big jump that happens when you turn age 50 in the exchanges, that your premiums are, in some cases, significantly higher because of just, again, the fact that that is allowed to be, you know, an underwriting calculation. To address that problem, which, again, hits individuals and small businesses the hardest, about 50 of us have a bill to basically allow a Medicare buy-in for individuals, which would allow them to, at age 50 and up, to elect to pay the premium for a Medicare plan, which, you know, the numbers that we've run through the Kaiser family is that that would be about a 40% savings in premium compared to what you can get on the health exchanges. That's big. Yeah, you know, that's real money. And Medicare obviously is a well-established program. You know, provider acceptance goes back now over 50 years. And we would allow that to also be used by small business owners because, again, as someone who used to be a small employer, I can remember that when I had a staff person in my office hit the age 50 or 55, you know, when you got your quotes for the next year, that's what drove it spiked up premium. So allowing small businesses to also use Medicare as an option for 50 and plus employees is again, a way, I think, of helping a lot of them, legitimate complaints that are out there. This is not a mandate. This is not a replacement of the entire system. So it's not the full
single payer.
Correct. But I think, you know, we just saw a poll just a couple days ago that actually measured this, and there was like 80% support for this kind of optional choice that we would provide out there for a program that we know actually would result in savings for folks.
Before we head to break, we've been talking about the Republican tax bill with 2nd District Congressman Joe Courtney. If you have a question, you can join the conversation this hour, 860-275-7266. Aridia is calling from Groton. Aridia, go ahead with your question.
Thank you for taking my call. My question has to do with the tuition. I'm just curious if the GI Bill or the Connecticut tuition waiver program for veterans would be affected. Would that be considered taxable income?
Thank you for asking that. The answer is no. I mean, the tuition waiver is a very sort of specific provision in the tax code for graduate students that, again, you know, we want to, you know, get smart people in places like UConn out there as teaching assistants and doing research projects, because UConn is now becoming one of the top research universities in the country. So that's a very, you know, laser-like focus, but it's a big deal if you're a graduate student, if you're suddenly being told your taxable income is going up $25,000, $30,000. But the GI Bill is safe and secure. We actually passed a bipartisan bill earlier this Congress that, you know, fixed some problems, particularly for National Guard folks' eligibility. And as you probably know, you know, it's really, I think, one of the most successful programs. And I'm very proud to have been back there in 2008, when we passed the post-9/11 bill, because it just created a lot of new opportunities. It's a transferable benefits for children, for eligible service members, and it's a great success.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Joe Courtney's here with us. You can follow the conversation on Facebook Live. Leave questions for Congressman Courtney there. You can also call in 860-275-7266. After the break, we're going to talk about defense spending and some other issues and continue to take your calls. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Last week, the U.S. House passed a $700 billion defense spending bill. The Senate's expected to take it up after Thanksgiving. Now, securing federal dollars for defense spending is an important issue for Connecticut's 2nd Congressional District, with Subbase New London and Subbuilders Electric Boat in the southeast part of the state. In studio with us today is Congressman Joe Courtney. Our conversation is also on Facebook Live. Just search Where We Live. You can ask Representative Courtney a question in a couple of ways on Facebook in the comments section. Also, you can call in at 860-275-7266. Find us on Twitter at Where We Live. Congressman Courtney, before we get into what's in the defense spending bill and how it helps Connecticut, I did want to bring up naval preparedness. There were several incidents within the U.S. Navy, two deadly collisions that took the lives of sailors, including two here in Connecticut. I wanted you to talk a little bit about what you have heard from the U.S. Navy. I know there were hearings. You're a ranking member on the Sea Power and Projection Forces Subcommittee. How did this happen, and what steps are being taken to ensure that this doesn't happen again?
Sure. Well, thank you for asking this question, because, as I said, this hits really close to home. And two wonderful young men, wonderful families, and at the outset, it just should never have happened. I mean, we're not talking about ships that were in a combat zone. They were, you know, particularly in both instances, because they were close to ports of friends and allies, you know, at a sort of routine sort of patrolling time period. And so in the wake of it, the Chief of Naval Operations, John Richardson, and his vice CNO, William Moran, ordered a 60-day review, which we've gotten that back already, and we've had two briefings at Sea Power where we've kind of gone through what the initial findings are. There's going to be also sort of like the police report that's just about getting finished. And again, having seen these in the past, we had a collision with a submarine actually about 7 years ago, the Hartford, over in the Straits of Hormuz. And the tick-tock in the analysis is incredibly intense. And then lastly, the new Secretary of the Navy, Richard Spencer, is also going to be coming out with his own report within probably sometime in December. The report shows, number one, these are concentrated in one area, which is the 7th Fleet in Western Pacific. And it's not happening in the Atlantic. It's not happening in the Middle East, where, again, we've got Navy ships out there doing hard work and great sailors and officers. And that's really where I think, you know, it's the surface fleet that's where it's happening. You know, I think that's really what I think the real bothersome question is just, you know, there's something going on here that is different. And the report came out with 57 recommendations to change, you know, the way things are being done. Some of them are already being implemented. Frankly, sleep schedules, because both of these happened in early hours. You know, that's being looked at. There is a lot being done in terms of just the qualifications for sailors, in terms of making sure that people are actually certified in terms of seamanship, navigation, you know, sort of the nuts and bolts of operating ships before they're put on the helm. being confronted with very kind of busy ports and activity that's out there right now. And then there's another sort of overarching issue about the fact that our fleet and the 7th Fleet is called a forward deployed fleet. They don't come home for training and repairs the way the other different fleets around the world do. And that's part of the problem here, is that these ships were being sent out there, and to put it as clearly as I can, they just were cutting corners in terms of putting people in positions who, again, had not gotten their certifications, which is almost like getting a driver's license, before you get behind the wheel of a car. And again, what's happening with a lot of these ships is that they are upgrading the technology all the time. So they're putting in new sonars, they're putting in new equipment that, even the most experienced sailor needs to get sort of spend some time learning before, you send them underway. The pace of deployment out there in the Western Pacific is very intense. I mean, the South China Sea is, as we know, a very contested area, North Korea. So the sort of heel-to-toe deployment of these ships is putting a lot of pressure on the operational commander to get them out there. But they are not really making sure that the ships are ready to go when they're doing that. And again, that's going to be something that Congress needs to address, because there are, frankly, some statutory issues that are creating that sort of conflicted arrangement that's there. In the submarine fleet, anytime they install new equipment, if you're a sonar man, if you're somebody in the operation command area of the ship, you lose your qualifications. You got to start over from scratch, and that sub does not deploy until everybody has been signed off. And the margin for error when you're operating in a environment that does not sustain human life, I mean, that you've got to do it that way. And frankly, I think a lot of those sort of restrictions and controls need to be applied to the surface fleet, particularly in the Western Pacific.
You mentioned longer deployments. I wanted to talk a little bit about sleep deprivation.
Yep.
We have a clip of U.S. Senator John McCain, again, chair of the Armed Services Committee. This was the September hearing.
Yes.
Into this Chief of Naval Operations Admiral John Richardson, who you mentioned. Senator McCain is asking the admiral whether it's true that some sailors are working 100-hour weeks.
Sir, I'll not deny that. The sailors are working very hard. We have been doing some work-study, sort of work-day type of studies. We've got some, particularly in the DDGs, the cruisers, the Arleigh Burke-class destroyers, and we're starting to respond to that by supplementing the crews.
Okay, but I just point out, if we know that somebody's working a 100-hour work week, I'm not sure we need a study.
It's frustration from Senator McCain.
And good for him. I mean, really, it's just common sense at some point that a 100-hour work week, I don't care what you're doing, driving a truck, passing laws. I mean, at some point, it's going to catch up with you. And again, if you've ever, for people who've been on a DDG or a cruiser, particularly in the areas where they're looking at the screens that tell what's going on out there. These are darkened rooms. I mean, you're really almost like in a like a photo lab, with the low lighting, because that obviously makes the screens easier to follow. But I'll tell you, it's a really kind of, when you're talking about sleep deprived people, it's just not. We've got to do better than that. So the submarine fleet, again, just to go back to that, they actually changed the sleeping rules, the circadian requirements, so that they now go to 8-hour sleep shifts. Traditionally, historically, it was 6 hours for many, many years. But the undersea research lab down in Groton, which is kind of the MIT of the submarine fleet in terms of studying these kinds of issues, after an exhaustive analysis, they realized that it was starting to sort of snowball for sailors in terms of their ability to function, and they've changed that sleeping pattern, and the feedback so far has been very positive, that people are more alert. You get a chance to just kind of let your body sort of hit the refresh button.
I understand that some commanders were let go. This looks like it boils down to training issues and lessening some of these deployments. But have you been able to talk to the families of the two sailors who were lost? I mean, what's their reaction when they hear that this was human error that caused this?
So, again, the I have not talked to them personally, and again, that's something that I think all of us have to be very respectful of. Certainly, indirectly, we've gotten some feedback. There was a family from Maryland that was at one of the hearings that she was in attendance there, one of the moms there, and her incredibly impressive person, as well as the families here from Connecticut. I mean, looked me right in the eye and just said, "Fix this." Period. Full stop. And she's absolutely right. We owe it to those families to change what's happening out there, because there's sailors right now as we're sitting here that are doing important work for the country, and we got to make sure that that we're doing everything we can to make sure that they come home safely. Mm.
Let's get on to defense spending. So the House just passed a bipartisan bill. This will obviously impact Connecticut because of the number of contractors we have in the state, including EB. Can you walk us through that bipartisan bill?
Sure. So the defense authorization bill, which Congress has passed every year for the last 57 years, is on its way to the president. It cleared the Senate at the end of last week. And again, this sort of sets up the policy for the next year for a whole variety of issues within the Pentagon, things like pay raise, 2.4% for people in uniform. No BRAC, by the way, because there was a flurry of news in Connecticut that they thought there was going to be a BRAC round. Actually, Senator McCain was sort of pushing for it, but that's not happening. Again, that was not included in the measure.
And when you say BRAC, so not closing bases.
Yeah, the base closing. That's correct. And Sea Power, we do the shipbuilding plan for the country. And, last year under the Obama administration, the force structure assessment was released, which basically was the Navy's strategic review about what's needed in terms of, not just the present, but also what's projected out there. They boosted the projected size of the fleet from 308 ships, which is where the trajectory was. And again, a lot of that work has been showing up here in Groton with a lot of new people getting hired over the last couple of years, to actually 355. And the biggest sort of spike in terms of, the fleet architecture, in terms of, what types of ships they're recommending to boost, were submarines, okay? And there really is there's a lot happening out there in terms of the South China Sea and North Korea. But frankly, also in the North Atlantic, there's submarine activity happening there with the sort of resurgent Putin Navy that's happening. That frankly, it caught a lot of people by surprise because they thought those days were sort of behind us. But for example, we've stood up the air base in Iceland, in Keflavik, which is where the old P-3 submarine hunters used to fly during the Cold War. Well, that's back in operation now with the new upgraded P-8s that are happening. And it's not happening in a vacuum. It's out there. So, what that means is that, the boost in spike in work down in Groton, which, I was sharing with you, that has gone from 10,000 to 16,000 this year. 10,000 back in roughly about 2010, 2011, we passed the 16,000 mark. 3,000 hires this year. I mean, I just want to leave that marinate in people's mind. 3,000, and we're talking about metal trades, engineering, and design just in this year that's happened in Groton. And the projection is that to hit the targets, even before we talk about going to a 66 fleet submarine fleet, which is what the force structure assessment called for, I mean, we're really looking at probably another 15,000 hires between now and 2020, the mid-2020s and 2030.
Are there people in Connecticut that EB is able to hire that are qualified, or what's the latest?
The Wall Street Journal actually had a big article just last week that sort of raised that question. I mean, the good news is that we're seeing, a lot of activity that actually has already been going on with the Workforce Investment Board in Eastern Connecticut, which is sort of the employer educator, community structure that has been put into place by the Federal Workforce Investment Act. And we've got some great leadership down there that have started up pre-apprenticeship programs and outside programs that has already been feeding this, pipeline into the hiring that I just described earlier. I was talking to a friend actually this morning whose brother just graduated Friday from a design program that the Workforce Board organized. There were 17 graduates, and they have interviews already lined up with Electric Boat to get a job. This morning, I check every morning in terms of what the job opening situation is down there. It's kind of like that and how the Celtics did last night. And this morning, it's 273 openings that are there. You know, I'm actually bullish on the fact that we're gonna hit that. The community colleges have been standing up, you know, metal trades program. Three Rivers has a sheet metal program. QVCC up in the quiet corner there, you know, has an advanced manufacturing program. MCC's opened a program. The tech schools are really part of this whole sort of process that's happening. That class that I talked about that finished on Friday was actually at Grasso Tech in Groton. And by the way, at the same time this is all going on, Pratt & Whitney is also suddenly starting to get very much more engaged in terms of workforce development because they are going to see a spike in engine orders, both military and commercial. You know, this is a problem that, as I said, I really feel like Congress should be much more focused on because it's not just limited to Eastern Connecticut and it's not just limited to Connecticut. The skills gap that's out there in our country, the Department of Labor has in addition to unemployment numbers, they also have a thing called the job openings report every month. And the September job openings report was 6 million jobs in the U.S. economy that are open right now. You know, some of that's just normal churn that's happening there. But some of it is this skills gap where employers are really struggling to get people plugged in to what are really not, you know, sort of minimum wage jobs. We're talking about real family supporting types of employment.
We know that these jobs through EB and other contractors, they contribute to the Connecticut's economy greatly. It's important for your district, yep, especially. But there's also the flip side, Congressman Courtney, when we're no longer in the Cold War, so to speak. There are a portion of Americans who wonder why the country continues to spend billions of dollars modernizing these fleets, the nuclear triad. Right. Can you talk a little bit about that? Like, why is the need there?
So, again, I think it's important to put it into context that, you know, I talked about a 355-ship Navy. At the height of the Cold War, we had close to a 600-ship Navy, okay? And we had, you know, many, many more people in uniform. We had many, many more planes and, you know, platforms throughout the Pentagon here. So the scope of what we're talking about here, to describe it as a new Cold War, I think, is a real overstatement. Medvedev, Putin's deputy, you know, was throwing that rhetoric around in Munich at a European conference not too long ago, and I don't view it that way. Having said that, I mean, there's just no question we've got a rival and a challenger that has shown some real hostility in terms of just incursions into neighboring countries, Georgia Republic and Ukraine, as well as obviously the cyber arena, which is not just limited to the U.S. but also to Europe. But they're you know, we're seeing NATO allies now whose own defense budgets had been, you know, less than 2% of GDP now starting to really invest heavily because they're right there and they're seeing it happen. And nobody wants to start, any kind of trouble out there. And certainly I'm not one of them. But I do think we need a Navy. And I do think that a lot of this work is about replacing the legacy fleets that are retiring, the old Los Angeles class submarines, which were built back in the 80s and 90s. They're coming to the end of their shelf life. And there's a need out there just to make sure that we've got that deterrent capability, which I think, frankly, right now in North Korea is very important. And I think the people down in that part of our state are doing good things for the country.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. In studio with us, 2nd District Congressman Joe Courtney. After the break, we're going to take more of your calls, 860-275-7266. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. 2nd District Congressman Joe Courtney is live in studio with us. You can join the conversation, 860-275-7266. Before we run out of time, I'm just going to try to do a lightning round with you, Congressman Courtney. We did hear from a listener on Facebook who wanted to know your views on net neutrality. And we understand a political reporting FCC will repeal net neutrality rules, which means that this would rules that prohibit internet service providers from blocking or slowing web traffic or creating so-called paid internet fast lanes. What's your reaction to that, and what can be done?
I think it's atrocious, and I think that the net neutrality rule that the prior FCC chairman Tom Wheeler put together was really balanced, And really, it is going to create the haves and the have-nots in terms of internet access. This is a real hit on small business. I mean, one of the things that, you know, small businesses have been able to use is the internet as a cheap way of marketing and advertising. And now, you know, this is just going to add another, I think, unnecessary cost to running a business. And obviously, there's going to be an income disparity in terms of its impact on people. You know, again, I'm just kind of appalled that a rule that really was very thoughtfully put together by the prior chairman is just getting, you know, just swept away with really little or no debate. Congress really should step in and protect that prior arrangement.
Raymond's calling from Waterford. Raymond, go ahead with your question.
Good morning. Thank you, Joe, for your dedication and service. I really know exactly what you do, and I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Raymond.
I would like to understand the national debt and how either party intends to pay it off, basically, or get it down so that it does not control our budget. I think you work a lot in that area, and I'd appreciate your thoughts.
Sure. Real quickly, I mean, I think that, you know, candidate Trump actually talked about, you know, closing some loopholes on the campaign trail, which I think there'd be great bipartisan support for. For example, the carried interest provision, which is, you know, I talked to accountants who just, you know, lose their minds talking about how unfair that is, that, you know, there are certain hedge fund managers who can claim a dividend tax rate for using, you know, for basically being involved with other people's money. Again, that's a no-brainer that we could, you know, bring down the debt, and I wish that that was part of the tax plan. It's not. There are frankly ways that I think we can reduce spending in the federal budget, and you know, one of the ones that I hear constantly in the district, and it's in their right, is just that Medicare can be a better buyer out there in terms of services, particularly in the area of prescription drugs. And that Medicare bill that I mentioned earlier actually incorporates those kinds of savings. So, again, that's the sort of, you know, spending side, revenue side way that really pretty, I think, consensus areas that we could move very quickly to help sort of narrow the deficit.
Camilla writes on Facebook about the DACA program for immigrant youth, undocumented youth, that President Trump ended that program. Now Congress is currently working on the DREAM Act, a bipartisan solution, again, to give these youth a pathway to citizenship. It's been a bill that's been reintroduced many times over the years. She wants to know the best chance for the DREAM Act could be to be part of the end-of-year spending bill, and is this something that you would support?
Absolutely. I mean, you're a very astute observer. There is a clean bill that's out there. Unfortunately, it hasn't, you know, been discharged to the floor for a vote, which I actually think it would pass if we had that chance. Just for the record, we actually passed it in December 2010 in the House. I remember Luis Gutierrez, you know, openly weeping when that happened there. But in any case, you know, at this point, it does seem like the one sort of pathway is to get on a must-pass bill, and the spending bill is the one that I think people are focused on. And I would just say stay tuned. Again, I wish we could just, you know, do a clean bill, get it to the president. He said he would sign it, and I think we should take him up on his offer.
I wanted to bring up the opioid crisis sweeping the country, also here in New England. A question about the availability of fentanyl and the fact that when you look at the overall drug deaths in the first part of 2017, a majority of them, fentanyl is part of that. And we look at how it's a disproportionate effect on rural areas, including Norwich and New
right.
London, who you represent. I mean, what are some solutions to help with that? I was under the impression that the ACA, under the ACA, there are ways to help people dealing with substance abuse, addiction, also treatment programs. What can be done?
So, again, ACA did provide a lot more access to behavioral health. And, again, as we were going through the ordeal of repeal, you know, that was a community that really ramped up loud and clear, is that, you know, eliminating Medicaid coverage for behavioral health and the essential benefits in the you know, Affordable Care Act health plans would really be a huge step backwards. But having said that, I mean, we had the DEA agent for New England with the New England caucus last week, Mr. Ferguson, brief us up in terms of what's happening out there. The fentanyl spike that's happening in Connecticut, the figure he gave us was a 544% increase in fentanyl-related deaths in the state of Connecticut, which is just, again, we sort of started with a low base, but still, that is a frightening trend. This stuff is poison. And there are some good things happening in terms of DEA sort of, using intelligence, and there's a sort of iron triangle between Mexico, Dominican Republic, and the U.S. in terms of where this stuff is coming in from. So that, you know, the enforcement side on fentanyl, which again, I just think, you know, has got to be a part of a strategy here, is important. Secondly, the president did issue that public health emergency to opioids, and I, you know, tip my hat to him. And there were some changes, you know, administratively in terms of trying to, eliminate some barriers for treatment. But the public health emergency fund has $57,000 in it for the entire country. So that's something that in that spending bill that Camilla asked about, you know, we've got to get serious about sort of treating this, you know, like a natural disaster in terms of getting more help out there.
Dan wanted to head back to the health care issue. Dan from Marlboro, go ahead with your question.
Hi, this is Dan from Marlboro, Connecticut.
Hi, Dan.
I just want to say, I don't have time to ask the last part of it. I will call your office,
sure.
Joe. But your picture's on the piano in this house, let me tell you, as far as preserving the submarine service, advancing it, and also keeping the skill base intact that will be needed to build future classes of submarines. That is extremely important work. And it must be done because our submarine force is very critical to the future. I just want to say one more thing. Don't let our illustrious president mess with the F-35 program. Thank you very much, Joe.
Thanks, Dan.
The comment field said he had a question about Obamacare, but
okay.
Never
well,
mind.
Call the office.
Before we run out of time, I did want to also bring up the issue of crumbling foundations.
Yes.
This is something that homeowners around the state, eastern part of the state especially, are dealing with. I think the state of Connecticut has put aside some money to help, but what are you doing on the federal side to help
sure.
these homeowners?
Well, two things. Number one, about a year ago, we got HUD to come forward and say that through the Community Development Block Grant programs and the HOME Act funding, that there is opportunities for Connecticut to take advantage of it. And actually, one of the initiatives that the state is involved with is creating a fund for testing, which is that's sort of a threshold issue for a lot of homeowners, and it's expensive. They did tap into $1 million from CDBG to help create that fund for about six or seven communities out in eastern Connecticut. I frankly think we can take more advantage of more HUD availability. There's a Section 108 anti-blight program that is a loan guarantee for the state of Connecticut that the state should pursue, and the legislature, to their credit, put in authorizing language to pursue that option. The second is getting a tax write-off for repairs and loss. And Congressman Larson and I have been working very closely with the Undersecretary of the Treasury, Dave Cotter, to get a tax guidance issued that would clarify that for people who have already suffered a loss or have taken the hit in terms of repairs, will be able to write or deduct off their taxes. Stay tuned, because I think we're going to get a decision really within a matter of days. And it's something that we've worked with the homeowners. There was a huge gathering in Ellington High School, right next door to where I live, a couple Saturdays ago, and the grassroots organic work that folks like Tim Heim and Brenda Draghi and others has done has been quite extraordinary. I mean, this thing wouldn't have happened in Hartford and some of the push in D.C. without the homeowners doing it the old-fashioned way. They don't have a lobbyist. They don't have a PAC. They're just out there, you know, doing what you're supposed to do in a democracy, which is petition your elected officials.
We had a quick Facebook comment from Steven, who writes, how do we as Connecticut residents with an entirely Democratic delegation make an impact on legislation we oppose in a Republican-controlled D.C.?
You know, call and write. I mean, I was on the floor really, quote unquote, telling stories from my district that, again, I think are helping with the echo chamber regarding state and local tax, medical expenses, et cetera. If you have family in other parts of the state, you know, Thanksgiving's a good time to, you know, kind of you know, reestablish that network and encourage them to call member offices. 13 Republicans voted no, which is actually for them to vote no on a tax cut is actually a pretty amazing event. But it was because of that external pressure.
I want to thank 2nd District Congressman Joe Courtney. We ran out of time before we really got going with
yes.
some of those calls.
I'll
Can we
back.
Have you back?
Absolutely.
Thank you so much. Again, also thanks to WNPR's Tucker Ives and producer Carmen Baskaff. Also, Kyone Wolf, our technical producer. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Thanks for listening.